Radio City yet again. John Grayson, Rob Ross hanging out and bringing you the best in the pop culture world, and even more than that, because we got a whole bunch going on. Boy, the sports world is exploding. I mean, we have seen over the last 48 hours some of the best and worst that sports has to offer, and a lot of it going on right there in the city of New York.
Well, let's start with today, since we do the show on a Sunday.
Yep.
And it's usually in the latter part of the afternoon. My beloved New York Jets just don't know how to get out of their own way because they managed to defeat themselves and let the abysmal Miami Dolphins beat them 31-27. The fact is that the Jets had a 14-point lead at halftime and couldn't manage to seal the deal, which I think is an absolute atrocity. You know, there was a lot of bad refereeing, some very, very poor calls on the field that went against the Jets, that's not the first time they've done that this season. Last week's game against the Patriots is a perfect example of that.
Right.
But the Jets themselves just play so ignorantly, taking such bad penalties at the worst possible moments, especially after you've knocked out the starting quarterback of the opposing team and one of their best receivers. You've done half the job right there, and you couldn't seal the deal. I don't know how the Giants are going to do. If they lose, I'm happy then. My beloved New York Rangers are possibly the worst team in hockey I've seen in years. They can't buy a win. Yes, they won yesterday against the Nashville Predators, but let me just say this much. When you're down already in the first period, 3 goals to the Pittsburgh Penguins, you come back and take a 2-goal lead, and you still manage to lose in overtime, I've got a problem with you. And then when you do the same thing all over again against your crosstown rivals, the Islanders, on a Friday night, and you come back and you tie it, and then you take the lead, only to lose it in a shootout. I don't want to hear how great your goaltender, Henrik Lundqvist, is. He's over the hill. He's chronically hurt. His contract's too big, and you're never going to win a Stanley Cup with him. And I'm tired of hearing about how he deserves a Stanley Cup. It's the other way around. It's a team sport.
Right.
So, but on the bright side of everything that's wrong in the world and wrong in sports, the New York Yankees lost in Game 7 against the Houston Astros.
I love these guys. I really love the Astros this year.
They're an exciting team. They're a young team. They're a hungry team. And they did the one thing the right way that nobody else thinks to do in the right way. There's always these shuffles for players at the trade deadline. And, you know, a lot of bad trades are made and a lot of rental players come and go. But, you know, on August 31st, when the waiver wire deals were at their limit, the Astros pulled the 12th-hour deal to get Justin Verlander from the Tigers. Now, you might scratch your head and go, well, isn't he kind of old for a starting pitcher? Well, it's been proven time and time again that a new atmosphere and being away from a losing team that you've been on for too many years is just the adrenaline shot you need. And that's exactly what it's been for Verlander.
Right.
He's been rejuvenated. This team has an absolute leader in someone like Verlander, and he's 4-0 in the postseason. And the fact that he shut down the Yankees in the crucial Game 6, and the Astros went on to win 7-1, and then last night they blanked the Yankees 4-0. Well, I never thought in my lifetime I would ever tip my hat to the Houston Astros, having been a rival of the Mets for so many years, and I haven't forgiven nor forgotten the 1986 playoffs. But still, a magnificent job by the Astros, and I really do hope they beat the Dodgers.
Yeah.
Because I never liked the Dodgers anyway.
It'd be nice to see.
If the Dodgers were still in New York, you know, I would not have been a Dodgers fan. I would have been a New York Giants fan. You know, I don't care that I was born in Brooklyn. It's the New York Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers, so therefore I'll stick with New York.
There you go. Well, a couple of things on that. First of all, with Verlander, I think he's one of those rare occasions where a pitcher is forced over time to change with the game and to change with his own age. And we've seen this happen a couple of times over the last maybe 20 years in baseball history where he can't blow it by you anymore. But now he's got to figure out the nuance and the finesse of the game. And Verlander's been able to adapt like that. And I think he showed a lot of that in Game 6, the fact that he doesn't need to rely on blasting a speedball by you. Because in the championship series, you're not going to do that anyway.
No, and the thing is, you're very right about having to change and adapt. And you know how they talk about, like, when it's a left-hander whose time is kind of past.
Right.
He becomes the crafty left-hander.
Right.
You know, Verlander, I think part of it was his mindset. I don't remember which one of the Astros it was who made the phone call to him before the decision to actually act on the deal was made, but it was maybe an hour before the midnight deadline. One of the Astros said, let me call him and talk to him. And he basically said, look, you know the Tigers are rebuilding. They're looking to dump your contract and salary anyway. You're not going to resign with them. You want to win? Come here. This team will listen to you.
Right.
You're what we need. Not we're what you need, but you're what we need. And I think that made him feel very good, you know, and very positive. And with that kind of positive vibe, he just put in the word and said, you know what? I'll go to Houston.
Yeah. Right. And it worked out very well, and we'll see what happens. But like you said, I mean, with the salary differential between Houston and the Dodgers, it would just be so nice to see them able to finish this one off, pull it off, and beat one of the richest teams in baseball. Now,
they did beat the other richest team in baseball.
Right, right, right. So
I will give credit to the Yankees where they're due. They are predominantly a young team now, which is great, and predominantly homegrown. And I think it's to their credit that they got as far as they did this season, I think well ahead of the curve that everybody had expected for them. Maybe one or two more years away till they were serious contenders.
Yeah. I just want 6 games out of this. I mean, if we can get 6 games or even, you know, fingers crossed, 7 games out of this, I think it's going to be one for the ages. Now, a couple of things. In hockey, you mentioned the fact that the Rangers won a game, and yet on the other side of that, you've got the St. Louis Blues, who the other night lost. The team is 6-3. They're doing fine. But they lost to the Las Vegas Golden Knights, which is never going to be a happy headline. And the thing is, they outshot Las Vegas by 35 shots and still managed to lose in overtime. They didn't just shoot 35. They outshot them by 35. Unbelievable.
I need to look at the standings because out of the chute, Las Vegas has done phenomenally well.
For what they have, absolutely.
But you have to expect them to be fairly good because they've got the Stanley Cup winning goalie in net for a start.
Right. Right, yeah, and things aren't like they used to be.
Captain of the opposing team in the Stanley Cup Finals as their captain.
Right.
So this was a very well thought out draft by the Knights. So I have to give full credit where credit is due to their management. You know, that was a very astute draft.
No doubt. So, yeah, lots to watch for. And, of course, I got to brag a little bit, even though they should have lost that game, the Buffalo Bills. And here's the funny part about this is being a Buffalo guy, I have been disappointed and led to the altar so many times it's not even funny. But I spent 25 years in Tampa. So this is my A team playing my B team today. And the Bills were down by 7. They let Tampa Bay hang around, and Tampa Bay ended up scoring the go-ahead touchdown with 3.5 minutes left on the clock. And in 1 minute, the Bills had tied the game up again. And then on the Tampa Bay's first offensive play on their next series, forced a fumble and went in and kicked the winning field goal. So, I mean, it was one of those that was like, this is the kind of stuff that you hope takes Tyrod Taylor to the next level, that he's really showing what he can do rather than this was just a fluky game, that, you know, that he really can now take control of this team and lead them into something better. But like I said, I'm dubious. I've been here before. So.
Well, it's funny because the way it sounds to have unfolded for Buffalo against the Bucks is the way it seemed to unfold for the Jets against the Bucks.
Right.
Except it did go into overtime, but Tampa Bay, who had all the opportunity in the world, could not get the job done. But how many times did their kicker miss field goals and extra points during that game also?
Right. Well, back to the officiating for a second, because this is the thing that drives me crazy about the NFL. Call holding or don't. The inconsistency where you get a holding call that's a kind of a ticky-tacky, oh, he grabbed the guy's jersey as he was going by. And then on the next play, you see a guy who's got his arm bent backwards as the guy is yanking on his hand from behind, and that's a no call. I don't know why the officiating is so bad, but I don't think it gets any worse than calling offensive holding and then not calling one that's a glaringly obvious example of it, and they just let it go.
Judge for yourself, but you'll probably see in the replays there was a pass by Jay Cutler that was not caught. It was bobbled. It was almost an interception, actually, but it was bobbled by the Jets receiver who was trying to take it away as an interception. And you know, in the process of falling, was then grabbed by the Miami receiver, and they called it a catch.
Right, right.
That led to the first Miami touchdown. You know, there was also a call of pass interference when it wasn't anybody in particular getting in the way of the receiver for Miami. You know, you have the Jets receiver running and turning his head. He doesn't see that the Miami receiver is underneath him.
Yep.
You know, how do you call that pass interference?
I don't know. But that's the thing. It's bad all the way around, but there are certain calls that are just so obvious, and they blow them every single game. And so, I mean, here we go. And now, you know, there is one other thing about the fact that the Bills and the Jets are in the same division is right now, I think you could make a case that the AFC East is, in fact, the strongest division in football. It certainly shows in the records. You get the top three teams because Miami won that game. You've got the Dolphins, the Bills, and the Pats all tied at 4-2. And the Jets are at 3-3. That's not bad. I mean, they don't have a great team, but they don't have an 0-7 team either.
The Jets are now 3-4, and Miami is now 4-3. So, and there's your East.
Right.
So it's a competitive division, yes, to say the least.
Right. And so there's a lot of talent there, and that game today could have gone either way. I know one of the things you wanted to cover this week, there's a number of reissues and things that have, I mean, we've talked so much about things that have been reboxed and repackaged and reissued. And yet, I mean, right now, it seems like this is a feast for guys like you and me who are really focused on that sort of late 70s, early 80s time period. There's a bunch happening right now, not only with re-releases, but with people who are out on tour.
It's one of those good moments where there's not an overabundance, but what's coming out is the kind of thing, it's like somebody presenting you with your favorite kind of cakes. and you have to pick whether or not you want the whole cake or you want a slice from this one and a slice from that one.
Right.
You know, it's just, you know, an abundance of riches. You know, that's what it really boils down to. You know, coming up in a very short couple of weeks, the one that's most poignant to me, of course, is the Chris Bell 6-album, that's vinyl, folks, 6-album box set.
Nice.
Which has everything he's ever recorded that anybody's been able to find. You know, things that have not been released before, etc. And, of course, the last side of the final disc, album number 6, is a never-before-heard audio interview, the only one known of its kind, with Chris Bell in his lifetime. So this is some pretty heady stuff. And for me, being the completist that I am, I have to say it was worth the money just to know that I'd get this interview.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I've got everything else because it has been sprinkled out over the newest releases that we've talked about over the span of the summer, like that compilation Looking Forward, and the expanded reissue of I Am the Cosmos. But here you've got everything, and I do mean everything. You know, the Rock City stuff, the Ice Water stuff, obviously the Big Star stuff, the solo stuff, and this interview. And right after that box set comes out, around mid-November or so, early December, will be the official biography written by Rich Tupica. So, you know, for, again, people like me and fans of Big Star and of Chris Bell, this is just another highlight. Now, we've also brought up the fact, but now it's coming out in just a matter of weeks, Savage Young Do, which is a 3-CD box set through the Numero Group, mm-hmm, which says to me, first of all, and of course that's Husker Du, and what it says to me is that, you know, for years and years, especially if people don't know the backstory, the Husker Du estate, as Bob Mould always referred to it as, was at odds with one another and could not get on the same page to just collectively sue SST Records to either get the records remastered and cleaned up and available again or just give us back our tapes. Mm-hmm. But certainly they've managed to work things out that Numero Group is releasing material that was recorded in the studio by Husker Du before they became what they became. So we're talking about the most formative years, 79 to 81. Although it does include their first studio single, Statues and Amusement, cleaned up and, you know, remastered and sounding even better than when Rhino did it for the Everything Falls Apart and More compilation. So that's something to really look forward to. And I've heard some of the tracks because it was uploaded to an NPR article a few weeks ago. Sadly, the article came out 2 days before word came around that Grant Hart had passed away. So this is, of course, incredibly bittersweet release because he didn't live long enough to see something that he had sanctioned, along with Bob Mould and Greg Norton. So nevertheless, like you said, for guys like us, this is definitely one of those absolute gems.
Yeah, and not only that, it's funny because I want to stop you for a second and ask about this because you mentioned the interview with Chris Bell. And I've heard and been a part of a couple of interesting interviews this week, one of which kind of fell in my lap right at the last minute. I got a phone call and it was, hey, do you want to talk to Mike Love today? And my answer was, sure, why not? Because for all of the hate that's out there for Mike Love, and he really understands, I think, better than anybody, his sort of role as the villain in the Beach Boys story. I don't think he buys it, but I think he understands that that's what he is to a lot of people, and he's fine with that. But in an interview setting, and I've talked to him, I don't know, probably four or five times over the years, he's great. He's a really nice guy, and he'll talk about absolutely anything. And this week's interview was 10 minutes long, and it was fine. And we talked a little bit about, he's got a new album coming out, a solo album that's actually, you know, the Mike Love group instead of the Beach Boys. I think that's coming out in November. And the first track off of it is really sweet. It's nice stuff. And it's clear that he's having a good time being a rock star. So there was that. And then I also heard Sirius has been doing an interview series, a sort of lengthened interview series thing with Robert Plant. And it's always great to hear that guy because he can spin a story and he can, his love for music and for the music that came before him is so completely evident when he starts to wax rhapsodic about that stuff. And I could listen to him go off. And the great thing about it is that I found out that we have in common a deep affection for Ritchie Valens. And he went off probably on a good 4 or 5 minute bit on Ritchie Valens. And I could have sat there and listened to him talk about this for hours. And there's something about that. The last interview that John Lennon did, which was like 3 hours long in New York, just a couple of days before he got shot, is amazing. And for all of the spiky asshole things that John Lennon was famous for in interviews, that one was really, it was in-depth and thoughtful and funny. And so of those, I mean, are there those moments where either you've gotten to talk to somebody and had that sort of conversation with an artist or heard one that sticks out in your mind as, you know what, that's the interview that all other interviews should be judged by?
Yes. Yes and yes. First and foremost, there are two interviews that immediately come to mind where, you know, there's more on the tape than what was actually transcribed.
Yeah.
The first one being my interview with Peter Holsapple, who, you know, I look at him as one of the truly great American songwriters. For those of you who don't know who Peter Holsapple is, Peter Holsapple of the DBs.
Right.
Okay. Just to clarify that. And, you know, he could not have been more warm, embracing, charming. From the moment we were on the phone together, it was as if two old friends had finally reconnected.
Yeah.
You know, so he made me feel that comfortable. And questions about, at that moment, because this was done in 2012, about the then brand new album from the DBs, the first album in 30 years from the original lineup. When we got into the conversation about Big Star, forget it. I mean, it's like just a couple of, you know, old musos like us geeking out.
Right.
The same thing can be said about probably my favorite person in the world to interview, Richard Barone. Because apart from the fact that he's just such an incredibly lovely human being, never mind the fact that he is a great, gifted songwriter, producer, musician, talent, leader of one of my favorite bands of all time, the Bongos, he's just such a wealth of musical knowledge. He's, like me, a fan who gets into it in depth. And you know, when I tell you I transcribed, well, let's put it this way, it was something around the neighborhood of, I think it was about 4,000 words that appeared on Popdose. But that wasn't nearly as much as what was actually on the tape because, you know, we did this over lunch. It was, in fact, a conversation versus being an interview. You know, I did interview him in a more thought-processed way of asking the direct questions. We did this on two occasions. So, you know, if you want to say that I had about 6 hours of the two of us just talking about stuff,
yeah. You
know, maybe 2 hours worth were what became the readable interviews because I did them a year apart. And, you know, a good portion of those conversations are us Beatle geeking and Star Wars geeking like a couple of true nerds,
yep.
Which is great, you know, because I'll go to the mat on Star Wars and the Beatles any day of the week, you know, right down to talking about good old ST-2553, which if you don't know what that is, folks, that's Yesterday and Today. That's the catalog number for the Beatles' Yesterday and Today album. Yeah. And people like me, unfortunately, know these things. It's like saying NBLP 7001. Whoever hears it is going to know you're talking about the first Kiss album.
Right. Well, yeah, and that's – I think that, you know, there's a trick to it. Well, it's not really a trick so much, but there's one thing that as an interviewer, it's very hard – to remember this. And it came out a little bit during that Robert Plant thing because there were a couple of times, and I'm not hacking on the interviewer. I would name him, but I honestly can't remember who it was. And I was not aware of his name before. But if I were in that same situation, I would have a hard time sitting there and keeping it together while interviewing Robert Plant. So I get it. But the toughest thing to get the knack for is to ask a question that is concise and leaves the door open for a longer answer. Because there were a couple of times where it took him 30 or 40 seconds to get through the question. And I thought, just stop now and let him talk, you know?
That's the beauty of the questions. I remember asking Peter and definitely asking Richard, because I think Richard and I also know one another well enough that he could sense what I was going to say and run with it.
Right.
It's like, okay, I'm handing you the football. You go downfield and score the touchdown.
Yep. It leaves it open for a more complete answer, too, because the more that you say during a question, the less room you give to your subject to give a complete response to it, because you're narrowing it down so far that the only answer is going to be, yeah. You can't do that.
The thing is, it's easier to do that if you're doing the written form of interview.
Yes.
It sometimes works a lot better.
Right.
Certainly, I know when I talked to Paul Weller, it was definitely an exchange. You know, I asked him somewhat detailed questions because we were talking specifics about the brand new album and the genesis behind the songs and so on. But he was able to take apart the question and answer each part of that question with the same kind of precision that I put into it. You know, the how, why, and when. Well, this is how, this is why, and this is when. And then he would color it in with the where and the who.
Right. And so, to just go off on some of the stories that may have happened along the way. So, yeah, it really is. It's a time where we get a lot of these now. We get a lot of these kinds of conversations and interviews. And the guys who are making the music are not – they're not so slammed to the wall with either recording schedules or touring schedules that they have the time to sit back and tell stories about the old days. It's really nice.
Well, I think part of it has to do with the fact that you know, enough time has passed. And I know this might sound like I'm putting a negative spin on it, but, you know, the light isn't on them as much as it used to be.
Right. They have less to protect.
There's not as much pressure. It's a lot more comfortable and they're willing to a degree, let their guard down further because, you know, there's nothing to be gained here. It's like, yeah, you want to interview me and that's great and I appreciate it. You know, it's not – you're not still playing the game.
Right.
Yeah. You know, maybe some of the younger, not as experienced and not as well-tempered and well-schooled writers pull that kind of nonsense with the – certainly they don't show the older musicians, and I've seen this in places, I'm sure you have. They don't show the older musicians who already established themselves for a good long time the kind of respect that's due them because they have that kind of youthful arrogance and because they think, you know, being a writer, you have that power or whatever you want to call it, that you can just treat somebody who is for all intents and purposes a legend with that kind of talking to one of your contemporaries nonsense.
Right.
You know, they cross the line too often, and that's why I noticed there's a lot of very terse interviews out there. And I always wind up, even if it's not somebody I'm a huge fan of, I'm usually on the side of the musician because that writer should have known better. And
yeah, right.
We're older. We've been around long enough. And I don't think you and I have – I think you and I have always taken the lessons learned by those who went well before us to never fall into those traps or make those mistakes. We're not arrogant people, and that's why we've always treated the people that we interview, whether they be, you know, very high-caliber legends like a Robert Plant or a Mike Love, you know, or you know, someone of a more personal scale but nonetheless still – of the quote hero vein for us, like a Richard Barone or a Peter Holzapfel, we treat them all with the same dignity and respect.
That's the thing, is, and there's another side to that as well, because you can show that kind of respect without coming off as a sycophant or a fanboy of, oh, you know, like the old Saturday Night Live bit. You used to be the Beatles, right? You know, it's not, you don't have to go overboard and right. Kiss their ass but you can show them that you respect and have a knowledge of what they're about.
Exactly. I mean, you and I have talked about this several times, but you know, it's no secret that Paul Weller is my absolute hero. And, you know, interviewing him was, of course, daunting for me because of all the emotional implications behind it. But I had a job to do.
Right.
And I wasn't going to go turning into a fanboy. You know, the thing is, when I was talking to him, you know, I made sure that it was clear that I certainly understood, you know, who I'm talking to and what this is about. But the one thing I was going to be damned if I was going to talk to him about the Jam, with the usual nonsense that every writer, especially the younger ones and the American ones, tend to do, is a, why won't the Jam get back together?
Right.
Really?
Right.
Do you have to ask that?
Right.
You have to be that banal about it, and that so deliberately unschooled.
Yeah, you
stick to the fact that the guy consistently makes different music and tries to move forward no matter how old he gets or how long he's been doing this. He's always trying to do something a bit different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't approach something that has been done to death. He certainly is not going to give you, let alone me, any kind of insight as to the Jam breaking up that he already has done for the past 35 years.
A thousand times, absolutely. And you know, it's the other thing of going, well, wow, you're really great. Do you know how great you are? Yeah, I'm pretty sure he knows how great he is. But, you know, when I was 22, I was part of a radio show that I'm not putting myself in the same footing as Paul Weller, but I'm just saying I did a thing at that time that I was really proud of, and I still am. And it was the only time that I've done actual comedy with the intent of doing comedy, and it was all improv, and it was crazy, but it worked, and it had its fan base. And if I were given the chance to go back and do that again, no way. I totally understand that mentality of it was a great thing and it was fun and it had its time. And when I was 22, I thought that was the greatest thing in the world. Now I'm 48.
Right. Well, that goes hand in hand with a conversation I was having the other day with a friend who actually had brought up the whole thing with if Paul Weller is going to continue releasing these old 1977, 78 era, you know, Jam tapes, etc., why doesn't he just reform the band? Well, there's a difference between releasing old material that's in a can,
right,
versus reforming a band that's, you know, when you think about the Jam and you look at the overall history, and I would say 75% of what their lyrics were about, the Jam stood for one thing and one thing above all else, and that was youth.
Yeah, right. So how do you do that when you're in your 60s?
Right, and it would be an embarrassment. You know, if anything, if there's still a rift between Paul Weller and Rick Buckler, then if I would want for anything to happen, it would be that they, you know, heal that rift, become friends again, and that way everybody can remember the Jam as a truly unified, happy experience,
right,
rather than still being enmeshed in some kind of enmity and bitterness after these 35 years have passed. Because certainly, Paul Weller has not only mended fences with Bruce Foxen, they've played together and worked together in the last 7-8 years.
Yeah.
But the point being that, you know, what you just said is absolutely true. You know, I've gone back on a couple of occasions to the Punchline. And this year, these last 3 years, actually, 2016, 2017, and even into 2018 would be 3 years worth of a 30th anniversary celebration. 2016, 30 years since we got together as the Punchline and were named so. 2017, when we recorded our first single, 2018 would be 30 years since we actually released the single. And I was willing to take part in a Punchline reunion, you know, because it would make sense and it is a warm, nostalgic thing. But there's a purpose. See, it's a warm, nostalgic anniversary celebration of something.
Right.
It's not with the eye or the intent on, you know, once again, plucking a thread from, you know, rock's rich tapestry and taking our rightful place upon the rock's hierarchy mantelpiece.
Yeah.
As was mistakenly and misconstrued for when we got back together in 2003. Now, I will say I have not heard anything from anybody else in the band, and that's fine. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. I understand it completely. And no one's, you know, no one's to blame for it not happening or whatever. But the point is, it would be because there's a specific purpose. You know, with Big Star getting back together, I thought it was a very astute thing for Alex Chilton to finally be willing to do, because it was a way of paying homage and to say thank you to the people who for so many years really went out of their way to discover, find, and then share this music with the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a very fitting way of saying thank you. You know, and it wound up lasting 17 years until he passed on. So it all depends on the different situations. But what you said is absolutely correct. You know, would I go back and do certain things? No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
It's an embarrassment. You know, but at the same time, there are those who can do it and don't do it in an embarrassing manner at all. It's done with a great deal of dignity. And look at that. They've aged beautifully. I'll give you the perfect examples, the Bongos and the DBs.
Yeah.
They did it perfectly, you know. They weren't trying to recapture glory. It was the fact that people love these bands, don't care how old they are. We're also the same age. It's great to see you back again. Welcome home.
Yeah.
That's the feeling you get.
There you go. And that's why, I mean, things, you know, for a while, I think people were turning up their noses at things like the Moody Blues Cruises. And they're doing another one this year, I think in January or February. And they're bringing the Zombies out and they're doing a whole bunch of you know, bands out on the high seas. Okay, fine. And everybody on board that thing's going to have a good time. And if you don't like it, don't go. Don't buy a ticket.
The thing about something like that is also the fact that we're now in a day and age where you can't make money making records anymore.
Right.
You just can't. You're not going to sell. And most of us have various permutations of the old catalog and the various reissues that went on along with it. So now how are they supposed to make money if they are, in fact, a going concern? Well, this is an answer. I'm fine for that. The only time I'll thumb my nose is when it's something stupid like the 90s cruise with the likes of Sugar Ray and shitty bands like that, because all of them just suck.
There you go. But they would suck on land the same as they would suck out on the high seas. Now, that said, though, and you just said that it's impossible to make records and make money with them anymore. So on the heels of that, I have to ask, so why are you going back into the studio? And what is it that you're going to be recording?
Well, John, I'm glad you asked. I'm going back in the studio mainly because I haven't been in the studio for a long time, and that's just unacceptable.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like not going to the gym. You know, it's that kind of mental, musical, artistic, creative, emotional exercise that you need. You know, you need to nourish your own mind and your own spirit and your own sense of who the hell you are.
Yep.
And before I can't play guitar anymore, I want to still be able to do what I do and love to do the most. So I will go back into the studio, and I'm recording first and foremost two cover songs that I'm going to release as a single for the sheer joy of doing it, as an exercise of how can I approach two songs that I really love and make them sound like my own,
mm-hmm.
which is what I want to do. And I don't intend to do it in that asinine way of deconstructing them so incredibly that you have no recognition of what they are. I just want to see how well I can acquit myself of doing these, because they're both incredible songs and I think they deserve to be heard by someone who just loves them.
Okay.
That keeps it to an absolute minimum without any kind of, you know, funny business about it. And then after that, I just have so many of these songs, you know, backlogged now that without the Punchline to help me execute them, I might as well just do them on my own. And live up to the very long-standing complaint slash grievance slash accusation that I just always really aspire to be Paul McCartney by playing all by myself and not having to deal with any bandmates. But you know what? I like it this way. There are less people to please.
There you go. Well, if you do your own movie version of Give My Regards to Broad Street, I'll be the one that's sitting there in line buying tickets.
Well, you'd be the one also I'd have to call to kick the chair out from under me as the road. because there's no fucking way. That's the one place I draw the line.
Yeah, Broad Street was.
If I was gonna do a movie, I wouldn't be doing "Give My Regards to Broad Street." And God, Paul, what were you thinking? No, I would do a movie like the remake of Quadrophenia, and show Sting how it should have been done.
There you go.
Because Sting couldn't act his way out of a paper bag. Need I say, I will kill him.
I will kill him.
Yeah. Over acting for one stupid line in a stupid, metal jock strap, you piece of shit.
Now, on one side we have David Bowie in The Man Who Fell to Earth, and on the other side we have Sting in that ridiculous jock strap. I'm going to take Bowie every time on that one. So,
anybody over Sting. Yeah. When it comes to musicians and acting, I will take Paul Stanley, God help us, in Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah.
Over Sting, okay? Something as horrific as an Andrew Lloyd Webber Broadway show, but as long as it's Stanley Harvey Eisen, I'm down with it.
Attaboy.
Anything with Gordon Matthew Sumner, two words, fuck you, Sting.
Now, as we get to the fuck yous this week, we there have been a lot of them floating around. There's certainly plenty going on in the political world that fits into that category. But the Harvey Weinstein, this thing, just the story that will not die. And I actually saw it in print this week. I believe it was on abcnews.com, but don't quote me on that because I might have had the wrong website. But somebody put up a headline that said, a new poll shows that Harvey Weinstein-style sexual harassment isn't just a Hollywood story. No shit. So it's like, who is surprised? It's like, wow, sexual harassment exists outside the movies? Wow.
This is called, once again, false reporting.
Uh-huh.
Or lazy reporting. Or just non-reporting, really, when you get down to it. This is called bandwagon jumping.
Yep.
This is called taking a serious subject and, by doing what people are doing right now, negating it to yet again another hashtag.
Yeah. Oh, me too. Another
month buzzword and war cry and whatever you want to call it. And, I have to be honest, I feel absolutely no sympathy when I see people using that Me Too in such a flippant manner. And by flippant, I mean, it's like, here's the story I never told anybody before. You know what? There are a million stories that don't need to be told, frankly. Yours wasn't a rape. Somebody said you looked hot. That's not sexual harassment.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Because if that's the case, am I going to put hashtag Me Too because some chick actually grabbed me by the yam bag at a party? No, I'm not. It's not harassment. I don't care if she was ugly, if I didn't know her, whatever the case may be. These things happen in life, okay? And people can say, oh, you just want to say get over it? Yes, yes. Because what everybody is doing, like I said, is going so far to the extremes that it's negating the actual meat of the story.
Right. Right. That's exactly what it does, because you take – when you engage in that kind of equivocation, you take something that is relatively mild and put it on the same par and on the same plane as something that is harrowing and has been life-destroying for some people. You can't do that. You can't say this is the same as that and now we're all together, because what you're doing is you're taking away somebody else's pain, and you don't own that. That's not yours.
There are two factors behind this. There's one, with all the women who have now felt emboldened by the new feminism, which I'm telling you right now, like the left wing, women and the new feminists are eating themselves up.
Yeah,
they're their own worst enemies. Something that has chafed me beyond words, and let me just say, I don't even like the person who's been actually, as far as I see, victimized here. There's this whole story going around how David Cross, the comedian and actor, apparently made some kind of off-color comment to a not particularly funny or talented actor in Charlene Yee. If you've seen her, she was in Knocked Up and This Is 40, and apparently she was in House, and she did this god-awful movie with the drip Michael Cera called Paper Heart. I mean, she's a nothing. She's a zilch. She's not interesting. But she comes up with how David Cross made some kind of insensitive racial statement to her 10 years ago. And this is being splashed now almost as, voraciously as the Harvey Weinstein thing is. And David Cross's own wife, actress Amber Tamblyn, threw him under the bus by saying, "I believe her." Okay, what is this?
Yeah,
this is what it's coming down to now. So there's that, because you know what? Then my wife can say that I've been sexually harassing her for 19 years, and you're goddamn right I have, because she's hot, you know?
Yeah,
I have a hot wife, and I can do shit like that. You know why? Because I'm married to the girl. But guess what? When I find her doing things to me when I'm asleep, you think I'm going to be going and crying and writing Me Too hashtag? No!
I'm going to be doing everything I can to wake the fuck back up. Yeah.
Right. Wake up. People grow up.
Right.
For God's sakes, perspective is everything.
Right.
Think before you hit the keyboards. I know you're a self-involved, self-indulged, self-serving, egomaniacal dipshit who needs to put every single fucking element about your own miserable existence on social media, but just take that extra 5 minutes before you start writing, and it may make all the difference in the world. Trust me, the life you save may be your own and somebody else's too by not writing your bullshit. Now, on the equally serious side of things,
yep.
You and I started talking about this last week, and it's still getting pushed into the background or swept into the background and almost being given an elbow of, well, this is not as important. Well, okay, if all the women want to go on and on and on and on about, you know, the sexual harassment thing, what about men who've been sexually harassed by other men? Or for that matter,
or by
men,
women.
Right, or been sexually harassed by women. What about men who actually have been raped?
Right.
This isn't funny. It's not cute. It's just as horrific and is psychologically and emotionally damaging as if a woman is raped, because rape is rape is rape, okay, across the board. It's an ugly word. It's an ugly concept. It's an ugly thought. And the fact is, get the fuck off your high horses. It's all inclusive or it's nothing, and all you're doing is blowing smoke. But you damn well better stop and think and show compassion for men who are willing, because more often than not, men are not willing to talk about such a thing.
Right.
You know? And how about, since you all want to be so righteous about how, you know, sexism in Hollywood and you know, all this shit against women, what about all the pedophiliacs and just disgusting, creepy, lecherous kid touchers that are out there in Hollywood? What about that? How come the kids aren't getting a voice in all of this? Nobody's saying anything.
Yeah, there's one other piece of this that when it gets back to the Harvey Weinstein stuff, because everybody's been talking about how, oh, now Quentin Tarantino's coming out and saying, yeah, I should have done more. Well, yeah, Quentin, you should have done more. But there's one other piece of this that I think is reprehensible. I want to be very careful here to point out I am not blaming victims. Victim blaming would be saying something like, well, those girls in Hollywood deserved it. They knew what they were getting into, which, by the way, kind of sounds like a certain president I've heard. But that aside.
Well, you grab him by the pussy, you know. I moved on her like a bitch.
Yeah. But
can you dissect that for me, please? Because I don't even know what that means.
I have no idea. Yeah.
I moved on her like a bitch. What?
But the one that kills me, and we've heard stories like this over and over and over again, is from guys in Hollywood who say, well, for example, Seth MacFarlane was one of them who said this. Well, the woman came to me, told me what Harvey Weinstein had done to her, and then asked me not to say anything. Don't fucking do that. You cannot do that. You cannot put somebody in that position. If you have been sexually assaulted or raped and you want help, go find any guy that you trust or any woman that you trust and go to the cops and get it done. But for God's sake, do not do to somebody that kind of thing where you come to them and say, I've been raped, but don't do anything. Don't say anything to anybody.
Putting the burden on somebody else is the easiest way for anybody to do anything. And we're not even just talking about something like that.
Right.
But because people, they grow the balls much later on. Oh, yeah, I just remembered. You just remembered.
Right.
How very convenient. When 50,000 other people remember, now you remember too.
Yeah. Yeah, but all that does is it takes somebody like Seth MacFarlane and put him in an impossible position. He can either betray a trust or he can keep other people from being raped. Well, wait a minute. How the hell are you supposed to make that devil's bargain? And he never should have been called upon to do that, to make that decision. If you want help, ask for help. If you don't want help, if you don't want anybody to know about it, which, God, I can't understand why you would make that decision, but if you just can't, you know, bring yourself to do it, to call somebody out who is a rapist.
To go to the cop and then to go to the press if it's someone famous and powerful.
Right.
Keep your mouth shut. And so it's like the guy who cheats on his wife.
Yeah, and wants Cole's to tell his buddy.
Friend. Yeah. Right. Tells his buddy about it, and then he feels so bad about it, even if the buddy can't stand the wife, feels so bad about it, and says, you know what, I got to tell her, I got to confess this. And the buddy is smart enough to turn around and say, no, you live with it.
Yeah.
You deal with it, because there's no, you have no right to hurt her. You were the one who got into this marriage. There was no gun held to your head.
Right.
She wasn't pregnant. There wasn't a need for this. You went along with getting married. You decided to fuck around. And now you want to, you know, feel better about you by letting her know that you cheated on her.
Yeah.
Guess what? This is on your shoulders. The onus is on you. The responsibility is on you. You fucking deal with it. And don't come to me with it again.
Right. Exactly. And I think more of us need to do that and to draw that line in the sand and go, look, this is yours. I have no part in it. If you want help, I will help you. But if you don't, keep it to yourself and don't drag me into it.
The only thing I'll offer you is, while there's tension in the household, my couch for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, there you go.
That's it. I don't want to hear anything else, and I don't want to catch you en flagrante when I get home.
Attaboy. Rob Ross, we got so much more to get into. And why not go from there right into, well, they knew what they were getting into. Trump fucking steps in it again.
Well, here's a double-edged sword about this, because one, in all honesty, and you tell me if you can think of anything else, who tapes their phone calls as a rule of thumb? Do you? I don't.
Yeah, I don't think anybody did in this case. I mean, think there's a recording out there.
Allegedly, here's the thing. Allegedly, the woman who Trump called and said this to, that conversation was recorded because that congresswoman with the cowboy hat heard it.
Well, she was there. She was in the car. They were on their way. The way I understand the story is that the congresswoman was escorting the widow to the airport where they were meeting the casket as it was coming back. And that's when the phone call came in from Donald Trump.
See, there are so many permutations to the story. I can't get a straight one, but I know, and I'm saying this because I want to look at every angle.
Yeah. Right. Oh no. Yeah.
A kind of, judgment call. And plus, this particular congresswoman is notorious for being a, look at how wonderful I am, and I did this and I did that, when she really plays like a minor role in most things, but she likes to take the credit. So mm-hmm. She's a politician. Take it for what it's worth.
Right. Right.
You know? There was – now here's the story nobody's reporting on. It was reported in a couple of places, and that was it. And again, I need verification if I want to go forth and make a judgment. But there was – the widow of one of the men killed in Niger, right?
Yeah.
And she got a call from President – what's his name? And she said that you could hear how distraught he was in his call, and that he could not have been more supportive and couldn't have been a nicer person and more caring in his phone call to her.
Mm-hmm.
So – where, again, the question then becomes, in the scales of justice, where does the truth lie?
Right. And unfortunately, there's no real way to divine that. The one thing that I think came out of this mess is that Donald Trump has no problem whatsoever making everyone around him look absolutely horrible. And I think he does it as a knee-jerk reaction to try to make himself look better, because the first thing they did was they took General Kelly, gave him a bullshit story to go out there and spout in front of the press that they knew was false, and he did it like a good soldier, and now he's the one who ends up taking the shit for it. And he shouldn't have had anything to do with it. The thing is, he's one of the few people that is keeping any semblance of decency going in the White House right now. And if they're putting him in a position where
his credibility becomes shot.
Right. And his only real option is to resign, because they just fucked him over bad. And I don't know how you can do that. I don't know how you can continue to work for a guy who is supposed to sit behind the sign that says the buck stops here. And he just threw you under the bus and made you look like a fool.
Well,
but
there's only one person.
I hope he doesn't quit, but I don't see how he can do anything else.
There's only one person who actually looks worse than Donald Trump himself, and that's Sarah Huckabee Sanders, because that woman is beyond. You know something? I'm a big advocate for just beating the shit out of her. She's a fucking abhorrent excuse for what we call Americans. She's so anti-American, and she's so against what we stand for as a nation, as a singular unit of people.
And so easily so, so flippantly so.
So joyfully so. That's the part, because she takes an abject glee in doing this.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm a big equal rights, equal opportunity for all kind of person. And I say she needs to be taken out and have the shit beaten out of her, be tarred and feathered, drawn and quartered, and the parts arrested.
Yeah.
She's just such a fucking abhorrent human being. Period.
How
she does not deserve any kind of airtime, any time of day, anything. She should be stuck in the most maximum security prison in the dark for the rest of her miserable natural life, and take her fucking father with her.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, and that part of it, I'm right there with you on. And as far as she's concerned, I mean, the one quote this week, and I was watching the press conference as it happened, and my jaw hit the floor when she said, well, I think it's starting a debate with a four-star general would be terribly inappropriate. Really? Would it? Really? For what reason? How is that inappropriate? How is, in this country, starting a debate or questioning anybody inappropriate?
Well, how did she answer that?
She didn't. She just went on to the next. She did what she always does. She shut the guy down and took the next question and pretended the whole thing never happened.
There you go. Need I say more about her?
Yeah.
And then on the flip side of it, right before all this started happening, of course, we had the whole, you know, he's a goddamn moron or a fucking moron, whatever it was that Rex Tillerson. Now, when I first saw Rex Tillerson, I just said to myself, oh, my God, they've gotten the whitest white man to become the Secretary of State. He's like the antithesis of what a Secretary of State should be.
Goldman Sachs guy, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Exxon.
Yep.
You know, I mean, for God's sakes, he gave me the willies probably worse than the rest of the rogues gallery. Why? Because you could expect bullshit from Rick Perry and what's his name? The other asshole who ran for
president. I just expect stupidity from Rick Perry, but
what's the name of that other retard who ran for president? Dr. What's-his-face?
Ben Carson.
Yeah. I mean, that fucking dipshit, you know. You expect these guys to say stupid, inept things because they are stupid and inept.
Inept, right.
But Tillerson was somebody who came out of left field, and I'm like, ooh, boy, This guy's scary because he looks like a guy that'll just drop a fucking nuclear bomb without any thought about it. And meanwhile, he's actually been, God help me for saying this, one of the voices of reason against President Asswipe.
Mm-hmm. And that's the problem, is that hateful people are now the voices of reason in the White House. And it's just crazy. We haven't been in this situation since 1973. And even then, I mean, at least say what you want about Richard Nixon. He wasn't a moron. He wasn't stupid. He wasn't going to bumblefuck his way into a nuclear war. So
let me explain a couple of things to you. let me give you one dick's eye view. No. First of all, I was on laughing. I got up there and I gave them the peace sign and I said, "Sock it to me." Second of all, I had my Jew.
Yeah, and right. Uh-huh.
Kiss Jew? Get me a Jew. Mm. I always have to have a Jew. Then third of all, I had John Dean use a pair of scissors on some tapes, and pretend that there was a cover-up.
Yeah, so on we move. Oh, God, it's so frightening.
And of course, also this week, let's not forget W reappeared.
Oh, yeah, right, and sounded sane.
Well, a couple of things about that. One, the not funny but just virulently true meme that had circulated once before was "Miss Me Yet?" and it's his picture. And
right.
He used to just say, no. Now it says 2009, 2010, and it all says no. Then it says November 9th, 2016. Sweet Jesus, yes.
Yeah.
Right? But he went to visit the family of a soldier who was wounded.
Right.
And the mother of the soldier actually tore into him, blaming him for, you know, us being where we are now. And you know what? He took it. He took it like a man. He took it like an adult. He took it like the one responsible for what had in fact happened, because he is responsible for us being where we are in the state of the world overall.
Well, wait a minute. You mean he didn't rip the woman to shreds and try to destroy her personally and professionally and try to bring up things out of her past?
He said, in essence, you're right, and I'm so sorry he showed the human side of him is what I'm trying to say. Yeah. And the thing is, it changed a lot of opinions about him because, first of all, he's not a politician anymore.
Yeah.
And people need to remember that. He's a private citizen. He took the responsibility for what he had created, you know? I've heard this said many, many times about him, and I think I have to agree with it now after all these years. He was not a good president. He was ill-equipped to be president. He certainly was surrounded by the worst possible people, people who were knowledgeable but bad people.
Yep.
Not what we're dealing with right now, because this is just idiocy upon idiocy. We've got President Camacho in the office now. This was someone who took basically the last dregs of the Reagan-Bush 1 era with him to this White House. And once again, you had the worst of the worst ruling the roost with an iron fist.
Right.
He was a bad president, but he's a good man. He's a good person. And he feels very deeply and understands now with a greater depth than he did before that he was wrong. And, you know, this was the other part of the conversation that I found interesting, because people said, you know, I have a different opinion about George W. Bush now. And there must be something to it, because he and Laura Bush are very close to the Obamas, and they've always had a very good relationship and have gotten even closer over the years, even before the Obamas left the office. And I brought up the fact that, well, if you go back to when, you know, Bill Clinton was in office, you know, George Bush was in fact very supportive, because as an outgoing president, you support the incoming president. Right. Doesn't matter if they're the opposing party, you support the incoming president. And, you know, there is an incredible amount of closeness between George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton. And that, you know, Bill Clinton is almost like a Bush son. And I'm not trying to be funny, but there's that kind of closeness. So it says something about the Bush family.
Yeah, Donald Trump is never going to have any of that. And yeah, you're right. I mean, if it wasn't for Paul Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney and the rest of those assholes, it would have been a very different administration. It would have been a much more measured response to September 11th. But those guys wanted war even before that happened. So, not to go back and redo history, but you're right. And that's the kind of dignity that Donald Trump has completely excised, not only from Washington, D.C., but from the country, by virtue of the fact that this is how he represents us. And it's just pathetic.
Well, that's the thing. It's all about perception. And for all the, you know, let's go back to Kennedy for a moment. You know, Kennedy fucked anything that had a skirt and
yep.
a pulse, and
right.
the pulse was optional. But it was kept out of the press because we didn't have that intrusive press back then.
Yep.
Right. Lyndon Johnson really didn't know what he was doing. You know, but they kept that under wraps because he was busy drinking himself into a coma.
Yep.
We put God's gift to paranoia defined as president next. No, no, I wasn't paranoid. I knew what I was doing. You know, and of course, the most inept burglars in history brought down by not someone with an altruistic need to bring down a corrupt government, but a disgruntled employee with an axe to grind.
Right.
Because that's what Mark Felt was. Gerald Ford, who only knew how to go and answer the cake,
mm-hmm.
you know, Jimmy Carter, less said about him, the better. I won't even get started.
But again, you look at his life now. He is a good man. He was a lousy president.
You know, Ronald Reagan, for all intents and purposes, he must have done something right, because we got through 8 years of the most prosperous time we'd had since the 50s. Yeah, I know he would never utter the word AIDS. And we did have Iran-Contra, et cetera, and Ollie North and all that. But this country was okay by and large. People complained, but everybody was doing okay.
Right, with all of them, you had good and bad to take.
Right. But I guess what I'm trying to get at, but I'm breaking down each one of them. You know, George Herbert Walker Bush thought he was going to be 8 years more of Reagan. And he blew it.
Yeah.
Is what he did. You know, you had 8 years of Clinton, who turned the economy around but got caught getting a blowjob in the Oval Office from an intern who couldn't wait to run fast enough to a friend who worked for the Republicans,
right,
while keeping the dress covered in jizz. I've yet to figure that one out mathematically. George W. Bush, Barack Obama. The point is, every one of those guys did the one thing that you're supposed to do as president. You keep a sense of dignity and sacredness about the office. If I became president of the United States and you became my vice president, or vice versa, I don't care who, you know, is running lead, you know,
yeah.
whether it's, you know, Jim Garner or Jack Lemmon, you know, everyone. The point being that we would hold it with a sense of sacredness and dignity, because that's what it means to be the president of the United States. that I would rule it like a fucking dictator, you better believe it. Because this country needs an enema. And right. I'm the one to give it to him. You know, I'm the big proctologist. You know, mine's the big fist, and you know where that's going. Donald Trump has always been, but again, this goes back to the fact that he's always been my problem. He's been New York's problem for so many years. You're now seeing it on the international stage. He's a fucking moron, an adult.
Right.
And that's all that needs to be said. He doesn't have respect for anything or anyone.
Got to get to the fun stuff, and we do have some fun stuff to get to this week, and so we'll leave that there and just hold our breath and wait for the next thing to come up out of Donald Trump's mouth or out of his Twitter feed. But that said, we have a couple of things to go over in the pop world because, our continuing series on 1984 continues again into an album that was a life changer for both of us. Where are we headed to this time?
Reckoning by R.E.M., the second album, released in April 1984. And, you know, there was so much promise that was hanging, maybe in an unfair way, putting R.E.M. in a very, very uncomfortable position, but a lot of promise with the unexpected amount of success that Murmur had in 1983. I mean, it was Rolling Stone's album of the year over Michael Jackson's Thriller.
Yeah.
Over the Police's Synchronicity. You know, but that in and of itself really does actually mean something, even today. But, you know, the thing about, and I don't want to draw too many comparisons because we're talking about Reckoning and not comparing the two, but, you know, Murmur was a very finessed, very textured and layered record when you go and listen to it. There's a lot in there. There's a lot going on. And it has a certain sound to it. Reckoning came out. And if you had seen REM in those days, in 1983, you already started to know songs that were forthcoming.
Yeah.
Because they were already doing them in their sets. They were doing Harbor Coat, and they were doing South Central Rain, and they were doing Pretty Persuasion. The huge difference, and I think this is also why Reckoning is so much of a particular favorite with so many people, this was stripped down. You know, it was pretty much almost like REM live in the studio. You know, bang it out in one take, and that's it, on to the next thing. And it was recorded fairly quickly, too. But the most important thing is the songs, you know, whereas the air of mystery and intrigue and I know I probably shouldn't use this word, but, you know, artistic vagueness about Murmur, this song was a lot more in your face. You know, granted, you couldn't understand Michael Stipe's lyrics. They were still as unintelligible as they were before, but they were much more upfront, and the sound of the band just explodes out at you. I still maintain this is one of the best produced records I've ever heard in my life. It's one of my gold standard productions. Once again, beautifully done by Mitch Easter and Don Dixon at Reflection Studios in North Carolina. And I remember Nick Lowe, when he heard Pretty Persuasion, saying, "This is the sound that I love. Big, booming, stupid American sounding drums."
Yes.
That was one of my favorite lines, but he nailed it right there, because the problem with Murmur is that Bill Berry's drums, which are always so dynamic and explosive, were just too compressed sounding. They sounded almost electronic by virtue of the tight gate on them. From the minute you hear the first slam on Harbor Coat, this record just leaps out and grabs you by the throat. And you go and you listen to a song like Letter Never Sent, and you hear that wonderful bottom end of the rhythm section between Mike Mills and Bill Berry, you know it's on.
Right.
But look at what you have on Reckoning. You have Harbor Coat. You have South Central Rain. You have Time After Time, Annalise. You have Pretty Persuasion. You have Letter Never Sent. You have Little America. You have Don't Go Back to Rockville.
That song. What a beautiful piece of music that is. So it might sound strange, but I believe you'll be coming back before too long. Don't go back to Rockville. Don't go back to Rockville. Don't go back to Rockville. And waste another year. You know, that's right there a perfect example that nobody really picked up on, of a direction that, holy shit, look at this rock band is going in this direction. Yeah, right.
You know, an unexpected turn towards country. Even though it was conceived as a punk song, if you've ever heard the early versions of it, whether it was live or first attempts in a studio setting, this album also has a song that I really just can't listen to because it just hurts too much to listen to, in that Camera, which we've talked about before. Mm-hmm. But this album was the stunning, perfect antithesis of Murmur. You know, it's kind of like that whole Rubber Soul Revolver thing. So too with Murmur, Into Reckoning. And this album shot up the charts even faster than Murmur did. And I think it set forth that whole chain reaction of a lot of bands to stop thrashing it out and turn it down a bit and be a bit more pastoral, a bit more folky, a bit more ethereal, a bit more thoughtful and measured in their playing and tuneful, and maybe get a little more droney, I don't know. But because this album appeared before the things that we've been talking about on SST and so on, this is the album that really set 1984 alight. It kicked off the whole thing in a way that it was the breath of fresh air that everybody needed.
Right. Right. And it still had a lot of the clang and chime that we you carry through, I guess, the rest of REM's career. And that really grew up. You mentioned being thoughtful about the playing. I think being thoughtful about the lyricism was another part of this. And it's not that Murmur was shallow by any means, but I think it reached a new level with this record. With Reckoning, it was a little bit more. It was a little bit more of everything. There was a lot more playfulness, I think, in some of the lyrics. And Stipe was growing a lot as a songwriter. And, of course, I mean, it makes sense because he was, what, 20?
24.
Okay. So, yeah, still. I mean, here's a guy who's still learning a lot about him. Yeah, that's right, because they were out of college. Still learning a lot about himself and the direction that he wanted to go. But a song like South Central Rain, the completeness of that piece of work is what always got me, even to the point of the way that the reverb on the vocals on the I'm Sorry part, it just added a little bit of extra something that set it apart from the rest of the song and let you know, without even thinking about it, this is an important piece of what I'm trying to say here.
I agree with all of that. Then add to that, it's also a far more emotional and, you know, truly from the heart kind of album.
Yeah.
Because you can hear grief in those, especially at the end of South Central Rain with the Oz part, elongated Oz. They just always really reached in and just got you. It really did reach your soul. And not to belabor something we've talked about, but on Camera, you know, if you listen closely, his voice is not in perfect range because it's really the overwhelming emotion of a true piece of a tribute to someone he had loved and lost. I mean, it was to Carol Levy, who had died in a car wreck, who was a photographer.
Yeah.
And, you know, they knew they had to do this song, and they knew that he could not possibly go more than two takes maximum. And by the end of that, you could hear like the wreckage in his voice, the emotional wreckage. So it is a much more heartfelt album than you would have it when you know the backstory behind all of it. But I think the main gist of it is why, even after 33 years now, it's still most people's favorite overall, because it's got so much firepower right out of the gate. You know, Harbor Cut, the one song that I always skip on this album because I prefer They call it the outtake version. I consider it the original version. I don't care for Seven Chinese Brothers. I wanted his Voice of Harold, because Voice of Harold is fucking genius, is what that is. If people don't know it, and really you should, but because it had this one hasn't been reissued in any kind of expanded version or just anniversary edition. Voice of Harold was the B-side of the 12-inch, the European 12-inch of South Central Rain. What Voice of Harold is the original vocal tracked version of what was released on Reckoning as Seven Chinese Brothers. The story went, Stipe was having trouble singing Seven Chinese Brothers. He was getting frustrated. Mitch Easter basically said, just take a break, relax for a bit. Here, read these lyrics, and throws him an old gospel album by a group called the Revelers, an album called He Cared That Much For Me. Stipe went ahead and lyric, word by word from the back cover, begins to do this as a full-fledged song to the backing track of Seven Chinese Brothers. It's hysterical. It is genius. It is absolutely unforgettable. And why that was left as the, quote, outtake B-side and Seven Chinese Brothers was actually completed is beyond me, because it was perfect in that version. Yeah. You know, right down to the way he, you know, he used a phrase which is taken, again, right from the liner notes. But he used a phrase that became kind of like a running REM in-joke for the balance of their history. You know, like, people would always say, a must. And that comes right from, you know, Voice of Harold. And Voice of Harold wound up on Dead Letter Office, which was the compilation of B-sides and outtakes.
Right.
But has never been reissued. But to me, Voice of Harold is still the track. In fact, what I got to do one of these days is just remove Seven Chinese Brothers from Reckoning on the iTunes version and just pop Voice of Harold in there and justice will finally be served.
There you go. That is 1984's Reckoning. And there's another album I know you wanted to talk some about this week, because as we back up 4 years back to 1980, there was an album out from the Teardrop Explodes that was, again, another groundbreaker. And it, you know, it's interesting listening to that album now in context of everything else that came after it, and thinking, okay, I hear echoes of this in bands that would never appear on stage together, you know, and yet everybody took a little piece of this album. Which one was it that came out in 1980?
Kilimanjaro, which was the debut album from the Teardrop Explodes. And the Teardrop Explodes never get their due and never get their shining light on them, certainly not in the United States, because most people know their closest competitors and former Zoo Records label mates, Echo and the Bunnymen.
Mm-hmm.
We're all from the same Liverpool neo-psychedelic scene. And Julian Cope, who, of course, had some success with his solo career with songs like World Shut Your Mouth and Charlotte Anne and so on and so forth. Julian Cope was the lead singer and bass player initially with the Teardrop Explodes. And, you know, you and I have talked about albums that have changed our lives. And this is in the top five of those that truly changed mine. I mean, when I first heard the Teardrop Explodes in late 1980, it was through our local college radio station when I heard a song called When I Dream, and I was just so transfixed by it. Transfixed by its circular keyboard riff and odd, crisp, neo-psychedelic sounding guitar chimes and this heavy-duty bass line and strident rhythm and the simple beauty of the words. You know, the ones that still live with me to this day, you know, and now I'm counting for two, and when I shout about you. It got to me in the same way that when I first heard Start by The Jam for the first time, you know, those lyrics lived with me from then on. And I immediately went out to get this album, and I got it on import. I think it was 2 weeks before it actually came out domestically. And I just loved this album from the moment I heard it.
Yeah.
I to this day define it as one of those perfect albums.
Well,
reads like a perfect novel, like Revolver, like English Settlement by XTC. you know, like Murmur, like Pet Sounds, like Repercussion by the DBs.
Right. Well, and I still think it's funny that whenever you pick out an album like this, you and I almost always start with exactly the same track, because When I Dream stands out to me as the sort of, it's like the bellwether for this album. And the production on it is kind of flat. And I don't mean that as an insult. What I mean is it's got an evenness about it that you didn't hear much at the time. There was a lot of jaggedness about that late 70s, early 80s kind of production in rock, in punk, and everywhere. And with When I Dream, when you listen to it, you know, it almost seems it seems like a deliberate attempt not to do that, to say, you know what, this song can stand on its own without any gimmickry. And that the rest of Kilimanjaro is produced in much the same way. But the great thing about this album, to me, is that unlike what was a very frenetic pace with a lot of the punk that preceded it, and even with a lot of the new wave that came after it, there is space in this record. There's a lot of space where they could just kind of relax and let the music be the music. That's something you didn't hear much from anybody, and this is a debut release from a band.
Well, part of that is the influences of, and here's where it gets very, very, very left field. Julian Cope's love for the likes of Scott Walker, you know, who at that time was a forgotten commodity, if not an afterthought and giggle by most British people, considering that the Walker brothers were never really successful on their own home turf in the United States, save for the minor hit, The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore. But Scott Walker was an enormous star when the Walker brothers broke up, and he had his own solo career and TV series and so on for about 4 or 5 years in the late 60s. Julian Cope was a massive fan of Scott Walker and of The Doors. And these were not exactly what you would call cool or something that you would consider to want to be acknowledging as your influences at that time, which he openly did. The thing is also, you have to take into consideration, he had a magnificent foil in keyboard player David Balfe, who, while they had a lot of contention with one another and fought a lot over the years that the Teardrop Explodes were together, he was sympathetic to what Cope wanted and understood and could transcribe it in the way that a musical director would.
Right.
You know, he had that appreciation and understanding. Also, they were produced by Clive Langer and Alan Winstanley, who were hitting stride with the likes of Madness and already had hits under their belts.
There you go, right.
You know, and also with Hugh Jones recording out at Rockfield in Wales, you know, who he produced most of Kilimanjaro. But between those sets of producers, you had different production teams who could understand what you were trying to get across.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Some of it was less is more, and some of it was let's flesh it out a bit. Because if you hear the original versions, certainly the original version of When I Dream is not as – it's nothing. It sounds almost like a demo rather than a finished version, because they'd recorded Kilimanjaro. They didn't like what they heard. They scrapped it. They got rid of their guitar player, got in another guitar player, and everything just took off like a jet right afterwards.
Yeah.
And created what you and I hear today, which is just as a magnificent a piece of work as one could hope. Not just When I Dream, but Treason is one of the most glorious things anyone ever recorded. I even recorded it for the Julian Cope Teardrop Explodes tribute series many years ago. By the way, that version of Treason is the same one just remixed, which had been originally released a year before as a single on Zoo Records. This is before they signed over to Mercury Records. But they re-recorded their first single, Sleeping Gas, which sounds so much more powerful and weirder and genuinely psychedelic on this album. Or track like Ha Ha, I'm Drowning, or, you know, Bouncing Babies, which explodes, no pun intended, all over the place because it's just so loud and throttling. It's just an incredible album that has no bad tracks about it. And the reason why it re-entered my consciousness and I wanted to talk about it was, one, I'd say around this time every year, not a joke, but usually just around the late October, Thanksgiving period, I always seem to go into a Teardrop Explodes phase.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens, like a yearly obsession, where I go back to this album and then the follow-up album, Wilder. And I play these two albums to death until around Christmas, and then I go into my Beatles bullshit. Also was the fact that it was, in fact, the 37th anniversary of the release of the album, and I was reminded of this because I was online, and therein lies the story. I was online, and I happened to see it in my crawl, and like one of my online friends had posted something that was written by a fellow named Mark Mortimer, and for some reason that name was kind of just bubbling around as I'm reading this really lovely tribute to Kilimanjaro, right? And I didn't read it, although, you know, where it says see more and then you click down and then the long thing just continues on Facebook and you can read the entire story and posting.
Yeah.
I didn't click on it. I just left it at that half thing because what he said was, I thought, really powerful and poignant. And I wrote and I said, this is such a wonderful piece to read because I feel so much the same way about the record. And I wrote my little thing about it. And he wrote back and he befriended me and we started to chat and he said – something about, well, you know, Julian was my neighbor for many years, and then it dawned on me who he was. And I realized it because he's one of the pivotal characters in Julian Cope's autobiography, volume number 2, Repossessed. The first one, Head On, is just a masterstroke of comedic genius. It is one of the funniest books you will ever find and read. You read it, you're laughing out loud reading this because it's so brilliant and twisted. But yeah, he was Julian Cope's annoying mod neighbor who kept trying to get Julian Cope to listen to Paul Weller, who Cope hated and to this day still hates. But a lovely, lovely guy. And it was great to talk with him and chat with him online. And then a few minutes after this initial exchange, who pops in with his recollections of recording Kilimanjaro but David Balfe? David Balfe, after the breakup of the Teardrop Explodes, started a record label called Food and signed a couple of bands. One was called Jesus Jones.
Mm-hmm.
It was called Voice of the Beehive. And the other was a band called Blur.
Not a bad record.
And he was also the focal point and the character behind Blur's first number one single, Country House, you know. Lives in a house, very big house in the city, you know. He was that record company executive that got sick of the whole thing and had done with it. Left Food Records, sold it to EMI, came back a few years later, joined Sony as their head of the A&R department, signed a couple of bands there, signed Kula Shaker and so on and so forth. So he had a very nice career. Then he decided to go back to school and get a degree in filmmaking, and he pops in with his recollections and beautiful memories of the Teardrop Explodes, not an unkind word said, but nothing. It was the way that I've spoken in the more positive terms about the days with the Punchline, especially when things were really great and we were all creating something together. And that was what I got from it, the notion of we were doing this together and creating something really special. We knew we were onto something, we just didn't know what. But it seems after 37 years, the what can be answered, and it is we created something special. And I just wanted – I had to take one of those moments and say I just want to thank you for this album because it has meant so much to me for the last 37 years. You know, it is a true life changer. It is a thing of beauty that has stood the test of time and stood it well. And you're absolutely right. You should be prouder than proud of this because it's just one of the finest pieces of work ever. So thank you for it.
There you go.
You've given us a gift. And he was a really, you know, he was a really good guy. And it was just, you know, to have that, just to reemphasize the sheer unadulterated beauty of that record. Because no matter what, you know, that's one of the most, all I have to say is just play When I Dream and let yourself be hypnotized by it.
Yeah, the album is outstanding back to front. That's Kilimanjaro by the Teardrop Explodes. And before we get to In Our Heads, one quick thing. And we mentioned last week, we talked a little bit about the movies, but had the chance to go out with my lovely bride last weekend and saw on its opening weekend the movie Marshall. And it's not a biopic. It's a story about Thurgood Marshall. It is a true story, but this is from long before he became Supreme Court Justice and Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, first African-American ever on the high court. But at the time where this story takes place, it's a pivotal moment for the NAACP, for whom he is their only lawyer nationwide. He's the only guy trying cases nationwide and gets called to take part in this case, to assist in a case in Connecticut, where a man has been falsely accused of rape, a black man who's played, by the way, by Sterling K. Brown, who you know from This Is Us. So Thurgood Marshall has to go and see if he can win this case against all odds, because at the time, a white woman who is accusing a black man of rape almost always gets a conviction, no matter what the circumstances of the case were, because of racism. So it's the story of the trying of this case. And even right from the beginning, the judge tells him, you can't speak during this case. You're not going to be a lawyer, because he didn't have a license to practice in Connecticut. So Josh Gad gets kind of roped into trying the case with Thurgood Marshall behind him and kind of feeding him all of the things to say and the tacks to take with the defense. And it's great. It's not a very big movie, but then with me, I think a lot of the greatest movies are small stories. This is a small story out of the life of a man who lived a massively huge life. So to take that piece of it and say, you know what, this is an important thing that led to the sort of legend that Thurgood Marshall became was very good. The acting is great. Sterling K. Brown, even though he's very identifiable with This Is Us, which is a huge hit television show, his presence in this movie doesn't get in the way, because he's an outstanding actor. You don't sit there thinking, oh, it's the dude from This Is Us. He gets lost a little bit in the part, which is good. And he's not the lead actor in this thing anyway. But what really surprised me about this is, with all of these great performances, we're used to seeing Josh Gad either be an over-the-top, oafish comic character, or a sort of a visceral, sarcastic character. He's neither one of them in this movie, and he's very good. I recommend this one highly to anybody who cares about social justice, or in the truest sense of the word, by the way, or history or any of that, or just a story about people struggling to do the right thing. And it comes off beautifully. I didn't really see any holes in this movie. It doesn't move real fast at times, but I think it did that on purpose. There are times when they take time to add some nuance to the story, and I think it was well worthwhile.
You know what's really sad? There's not been one word about this movie in the New York area whatsoever. I've not seen an ad. I've not seen any kind of critics' choice, critics' pick. Nothing, no reviews, no ads, nothing. The first time I heard about it was through you last week, saying that you were planning on going to the movies to see this.
Yeah, and I don't know why it's not gotten more buzz than it has, but I'll tell you what, I think this may be one of those that I don't know that it will win any big awards, but I bet it gets nominated for a couple of them. And at that point, it may start to get a little bit of buzz going after the first of the year.
Perhaps. Maybe that's what they're doing. It's a strategic thing.
I hope so.
It's strategic.
Yeah. So that's out there, and it's worth checking out if you haven't yet. And that, brings us quite nicely into the In Our Heads thing for this week, because I had this idea because of something that came up earlier this week about inside jokes, because you certainly know enough about music and about songs in particular that there are 1,000 jokes that don't mean anything to really much of anybody other than the band. But when you learn the story of why something is worded the way that it is, or why it has the name that it does, or why even a band has the name that it does, it gives you a little bit of something extra. It's like having a little hidden apple of gold. It's like, I've got this thing and I know, and nobody else knows this. And here's what I mean. Was listening to the iPod, and it was flipping through songs and just on shuffle, and it picked out Shakin' the Blues by Screamin' Cheetah Wheelies. I always love the name Screamin' Cheetah Wheelies anyway for a band, even though that was really the only song they had that did much of anything. And I found out later on, because I happened upon it in an old book of cartoons, that Screamin' Cheetah Wheelies was the caption to a Far Side cartoon. where I guess Gary Larson thought it was amusing that cheetahs could go 88 miles an hour and presumably travel back in time after they do that. So he had this thing of a bunch of cheetahs just out in the middle of a field, and there's these clouds of dust coming, you know, from the back of each one of them, and it just says screaming cheetah wheelies. They thought that was fucking hilarious, and so do I. So they called their band that. The other one is from the Goo Goo Dolls. And it's not a song of theirs that really did much of anything, but it's a great piece of music. It's a nice, hard rock, nothing of a song. It's called Am I Gone? An age-old game of rat and mouse, chasing us from house to house. I'm not saying that there's something wrong with you. What's wrong with me as well? Are you alive? Am I gone? Is it too late to call and tell you to be strong? Are you alive? Am I gone? Was the poison in our blood there all along? Am I gone? But it's all smashed together. The three words, am I gone, are all smashed together in one word. And the reason it's like that is because the Goo Goo Dolls are from the same town I am. They're from Buffalo, and specifically they're from Kenmore. And there's a string of funeral homes. I am not making this up. You can look it up if you don't believe me. There's a string of funeral homes, and they're called Am I Gone? Which is kind of the question that answers itself. If you're in a funeral home, I'm guessing, yes, you are in fact gone. But it's just, it's hilarious to me that Am I Gone funeral homes exist. And they thought it was funny, so they wrote this song. And if you're not from Buffalo, you have no idea why that song is called that. But, you know, there it is. That little inside joke was a sort of a nod and a wink to their fans from their hometown. I love that stuff.
You have to be astute, if you will.
Yeah.
To really get the jokes and you know, it just, you have to be on your toes for them too. I mean, certainly the Beatles were rife.
Oh yeah. Because of Lennon.
Certainly, the Ruddles are just a wealth of endless jokes. But you know, here's, I'll give you one that comes right to mind since you brought up the whole concept of the in joke and so on and so forth. Let me start with the Monkees, okay? Randy Scousgit is an in joke in and of itself because, first of all, the song title was banned over in the UK when they wanted to pull it as a single, because back then the phrases Randy and Scousgit were all considered too obscene for the BBC, Randy being horny.
Yep.
And Scousgit meaning lazy Liverpool layabout. Mickey Dolenz just thought it sounded cool. And they said to him, well, you need to think of an alternate title. And he goes, okay, that's what we'll call it, alternate title. So when you look at British releases of Headquarters and the 45 called alternate title, that's what that's Randy Scousgit.
That's funny. Yeah, see, so that's the stuff I love.
Now, the lyrics. She's a wonderful lady and she's mine, oh mine. And there doesn't seem a way that she won't come and lose my mind. It's too easy humming songs to a girl in yellow dress. It's been a long time since the party and the room is in a mess. The girl with Samantha Just, who was one of the hosts of, I think, Top of the Pops. She was the girl in the yellow dress. Mickey met her and was just... Cupid's arrow just
gone,
went right through, gone. And he chased and pursued her. He married her. She was his first wife. But the second verse, the four kings, and the way you hear it, it's so fast you don't really get it on first listen. But the line is, the four kings of EMI are sitting stately on the floor. And those four kings of EMI, of course, are John, Paul, George, and Ringo. And the story is of the party that the Beatles threw for the Monkees. That's what the song is. It's a retelling of that night of debauchery.
That's cool.
At the Beatles party thrown for the Monkees upon their arrival in England. So there's one that's rife with in-jokes. Now, here's one that's kind of timely, too, because we just heard this week about the death of Gord Downie, who is the lead singer of a Canadian band called
The Tragically Hip.
Right. Where does the name The Tragically Hip come from? The name The Tragically Hip was in fact taken from a Michael Nesmith bit in Elephant Parts.
Right.
The video has a clip of asking for contributions for the Foundation for the Tragically Hip, poor afflicted people in need of jacuzzis, Lamborghinis, and cocaine.
That's fantastic.
You know, in jokes are always rife. I mean, God, they're, you know, I hate saying it, but you know, R.E.M., okay. The song Little America, Jefferson, I Think We're Lost.
Uh-huh.
And Lawyer Jeff, he knows the lowdown.
Right.
And can't get there from here. Well, that was Jefferson Holt, their manager. You know, in jokes.
Yeah, and it doesn't, well, and with things like that, as long as it fits the song, as long as the lyric sounds good, it doesn't matter that anybody knows what it is or not.
I mean, goddamn, every goddamn song that I wrote was an in-joke as far as I was concerned.
Right. And you know, with the band name thing, like the Cheetah Wheelies, Screaming Cheetah Wheelies, there are things that everybody assumes are drug references that really aren't. And one of the more common ones from the 70s, remember the band 10cc?
Oh, yeah.
Now, you know where that name came from?
Oh, yeah. calling Rod Stewart.
Exactly, right. And really, the Love and Spoonful always, and here's the funny thing about the Love and Spoonful, is that they were rumored to have gotten their name the same way, that it was the average amount of male ejaculate. But that's not where the Love and Spoonful got their name. The Love and Spoonful got their name.
That's the song.
The Maxwell House thing, right? It was a Maxwell House coffee jingle about get your lovin' spoonful every morning. And there was a blues song that was created after that that was a sort of extended version of that. And that's where the lovin' spoonful came from.
It's like the Rolling Stones, the Rolling Stone blues.
Right, yeah. Right.
Charlie Yardbird Parker.
Yes, right. Well,
that was his original nickname, not Bird, but Charlie Yardbird Parker. That was the original his original nickname.
Right, and yeah. which by the way has a racial component to it as well. But you know,
are we gonna get tagged with being racist and insensitive?
Oh no! Hey, listen, it was the time, man. It was what it was. But you know, what was the other one? Floyd Council and Pink Anderson.
Oh, you mean the Anderson Council?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, that's where the Anderson Council got their name from, which it is.
Yeah, no shit.
But yeah, by way of Pink Floyd.
Dabs.
Right.
Whatever the fuck that meant.
So I love that stuff. So you know what? We're going to ask for more in the comments section below this. So if you know of any other of those sort of musical inside jokes, then by all means, post them here.
Come on. Sad but true. I mean, where the fuck did Big Star get their name? From a goddamn grocery store right across the street.
Yeah, well, as soon as Giant Eagle starts having hits of their own, I think, you know, maybe we'll see the trend set there. Rob Ross.
Stop and shop.
I'm not even supposed to be here today. Thanks as always, my man. We'll talk again in a week.
All right, brother. Be well. I will see you later.